of targets and could vector and manage dozens of fighters or bombers while assisting with the on-ground pictures during combat. The four-wheelers crept around their next threat, a village called Sine, and started up the slopes of a mountain named Wak Sok Gar. Their route was to take them over the top of Sok Gar's ridge-like summit via one of several passes they believed were accessible, which allowed them to bypass Menjawar, the village known to have as many as 200 Al-Qaeda fighters who'd moved into the region in anticipation of the fight. On the other side of Sok Gar, they would travel south toward the north end of Shahikot Valley to their OP. As they ascended the lower slopes, however, they learned another hard truth regarding Afghan terrain and maps. 1 to 100,000 U.S. maps had very little detail. Russian 1 to 50,000 topo maps were never as accurate or reliable as their U.S. counterparts, which didn't exist for the region anyway, and satellite imagery was inadequate for the man on the ground. Even Jay's Falcon view was only as good as the images loaded into the program. The trails and navigable terrain they'd planned around were proving impassable as the meters added up behind their vehicles. We continued to move south, trying to find a way over the mountain, getting closer and closer to Menjawar. Eventually, they stopped and discussed the situation, using Jay's Falcon view under the poncho. It was clear their carefully planned route was now blocked. They had a choice to make. They could drop back down the mountain, travel south along the lower slopes of Sok Gar, and attempt to pass through an enemy-occupied town to make their OP, or they could turn back and notify Blaber they would be unable to reach their OP, and, therefore, not accomplish their mission, compromising the upcoming operation involving more than 1,000 U.S. troops and personnel. Ultimately, there was no choice. It was now obvious we were going to have to go through Menjawar to get to our OP. They rolled to a stop before the village, tires crunching loudly over rocks and their exhausts advertising their presence, or so it felt to the men. They watched the silent village intently for obvious threats. When nothing revealed itself and their choice was made, we slowly moved through the town with streets as wide as 6 feet and saw no one, only a lot of dogs barking. The dogs set the men on edge, their peltors amplifying the potential threat that the barking would bring Taliban or Al-Qaeda forces out into the night. They prayed the Delta-modified exhausts would mask their passing. The main thoroughfare was no more than an alley, darkly claustrophobic. Every low-slung mud building had weapons behind its walls. Every blackened window masked a potential AK-47 barrel. It was about 2,200 hours, and it was a good thing that when it gets dark, the Afghanis appear to bed down for the night. The thing that worried us most was an unexpected checkpoint, but we never saw any. The men had their weapons slung in front of them for easy reach, fingers ready to grab pistol grips and return ambush fire, a no-win situation since their right hands were required to work the ATV throttles. If fired upon, they could return fire or flee, but not both. It was just above freezing, so there's no snow on the ground, but it's muddy, so you can see the tracks. You're not making that much noise, but at the same time, you're just waiting for somebody to appear over the top of the wall and go, "Aha, here's our guys," because they knew we were coming, that Americans were pouring into the Shahikot, that they were going to do some sort of major operation. With their biggest threat to that point behind them, they finally found a route over the mountain to the east. Turning south, they began to feel their way in the right direction, until along the trail, we eventually came across a bunch of rocks piled across the road with one big rock that had an X painted on it. This meant the road was mined. So we figured, one, we were very lucky. Two, the road was mined with anti-tank mines and the ATVs were not heavy enough to set them off. Three, we moved in the center of the trail and the mines were on the tire paths only. Or four, the area was falsely marked as mined to scare people off. As is so often the case in life, and particularly in combat, luck and events moved in unpredictable and unknowable ways. Jay concludes, So we were thinking it wasn't the smartest idea to go through the middle of Menjawar, and then we end up in a damn minefield because you can't really tell the difference on the rock colors on Nods, NVGs. J-Team had dodged their second bullet of a mission that was only 6 hours old. 10 miles to the south, I-Team and Mako 3-1 were winding their way toward their vehicle drop-offs along the route reconnoitered by I-Team only a few days earlier. The going was little better than on J-Team's travels. Because of the rugged, broken terrain, which caused the trucks to bottom out frequently, I-Team and Mako 3-1 dismounted some 2.5 kilometers short of their intended drop-off. John B. repeated his delayed departure procedure, watching the eight phantoms disappear single file into the night, each of them burdened by more than 100 pounds, like lethal pack mules. When enough time had elapsed, he turned his pickups for Gardez. I-Team and Mako 3-1 trudged together through the night for 4 kilometers along the valley floor, heading east along a creek named Zawar Quar, and then I-Team turned north for their OP another 7 kilometers distant, leaving Andy and the SEALs with a movement ahead of them that was more than twice as long. Neither team had much to say when they parted. It was a serious night, and all of them were now deep in enemy-controlled territory. For Mako 3-1, it was doubly daunting. Not only had they missed the hard-earned lessons learned from the recce missions, but there was also something to be said for the personal experience of having previously walked the terrain. What they lacked in local exposure, though, they made up for with skill, experience, and intent. Andy and Goody had no intention of failing to make their objective or an impact on the overall operation. To ensure they arrived at their OP unobserved, they'd deliberately plotted a circuitous infiltration route nearly 22 kilometers long. Though the least acclimated, Mako 3-1 also had to double their movement rate, reducing the time and ability to identify the enemy before the enemy might identify them. It was a huge risk. Still, they continued through snow that began to reach their knees, each step a posthole except where exposed rocky terrain provided some respite. Their painfully challenging progress was exacerbated by the snow that began to fall. Their misery did have one silver lining. No one in their right mind was out on a night such as this. While Mako 3-1 slogged through the night, Bill, J-Team's lead rider, was making a life-saving leap from his ATV. The team had been climbing through increasingly deep snow on steepening slopes as they neared their OP. As the three others climbed the trail behind him, Bill's ATV suddenly stood upright under the heavy load and 45-degree slope and tipped backward. Bill flung himself off just as 800 pounds toppled. Dumped in the snow, he and the others watched helplessly as the rig and his equipment tumbled end over end for over 100 meters before it stopped. Gear was strewn down the slope. While his teammates collected the equipment, Bill righted his ATV, checked it over, and hit the starter. The engine quietly came to life. Once again, they were grateful for their specialized equipment and the superb skills of the vehicle crews. When his rig was put back together, the men continued carefully across the steep terrain, eventually arriving at their primary OP site. But, as Chris recounted, after conducting a recon, we decided it was not a good site. We would have to leave the ATVs out of sight, with no good hiding place for them. They studied Jay's Falcon View screen, then loaded back on the ATVs and headed toward another site we had seen from the top of the mountain we were just on. To reach their secondary OP, they were forced to travel down into the northern end of the Shahi Kot, before cutting across the toes of some ridge lines and due east into another small valley that was the one with the confirmed cave and reported ADA, air defense artillery, and artillery pieces. The team ended up closer than they'd anticipated, only turning around about 300 meters before the cave and moving back to the mouth of the valley, as Chris recalled. From there, they found a secure ATV hide site, which they masked with camo netting brought along expressly for that purpose. After 9 intense and grueling hours, they finally stopped. Saddle sore but grateful, they removed their helmets and spent an hour doing a look, listen, and smell of their new base. On March 1st at 0447 hours, J-Team reported back to Pete Blaber that they were in position and open for business. As Andy and his team continued their heinous route along a 9,400-foot ridgeline, AFO's approach to the enemy and their historic tactics and daily rhythm was proving well thought out. It was unlikely any Al-Qaeda believed the soft-bellied Americans would be out in misery such as this or in terrain so forbidding and remote. Both served Mako 3-1 well and were critical since, as Andy observed, the whole way in, based on the terrain, we always had at least 90 degrees, if not more, of masking where anybody could come up over the ridgeline. So we were really, really shit out of luck most of the time. Despite their relentless march, the dawn beat them to their objective, and they stopped as a steel-gray sky greeted the exhausted warriors. With no choice, they established a hide site a mere 1,000 meters from their objective. In Bagram, John Chapman listened on the SATCOM net as his 2-4 teammates passed information or exchanged messages via toughbook. He'd managed to get to the war, but his only mission had been a bust. Now he was sidelined, again, tantalizingly close, but still a lifetime's distance from the operations going down. Chapter 13. March 1st. We will retreat to the mountains and begin a long guerrilla war to reclaim our pure land from infidels and free our country like we did against the Soviets. The Soviets were a brave enemy and their soldiers could withstand tough conditions. The Americans are creatures of comfort. They will not be able to sustain the harsh conditions that await them. So predicted Jalaluddin Haqqani on October 22, 2001. Haqqani was a Taliban Mujahideen commander, and his forces were already in retreat as he spoke these words from a Pakistani hideout where he would remain for over a decade. His words reflected the beliefs of most of the combatants arrayed against the pending Operation Anaconda forces. He also had the distinction of having been a commander during the Soviet campaign, and more important, its effort in the Shahikot Valley. Haqqani based his opinion on broad perceptions built up over the previous decade and reinforced by events in Somalia and Haiti, where it seemed Americans could be driven from one's lands by inflicting a few casualties. His assessment, though, was based on U.S. foreign policy and not on the actual troops on the ground. Ironically, this creatures of comfort analyst was himself a creature of habit, and his forces now awaiting the Americans were repeating their tactics of more than a decade prior. Blaber's and AFO's study of the history and geography of their battlefield was about to determine whether habit or comfort would win the day. Haqqani's understanding of where and when the first major confrontation was going to take place was solidified, thanks in part to the tip-off delivered by traitors within the American Allied ATF's ranks. But even before this confirmation of American intent, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda had recognized the looming fight's location. From the enemy. Our early presence in it, Shahikot, gave us sufficient experience and much knowledge of it inside and out, its dangerous parts and the ways out of them, and allowed us to master their use, by the bounty of Allah the Most High, for our operations with the Americans when Allah caused them to encounter us in that area. Mulawi Jawad was Saifur Rahman Mansur's military commander for the duration of the previous phase of battles. He had been involved in preparing the bases and occupied with arranging and fixing ambushes. We planted landmines accurately in the main roads, which led to the village, Sirkenkel, in the center of the Shahikot Valley, and we set up heavy artillery in the surrounding mountain peaks. In the early days, we spent all our time preparing the area. Our numbers totaled 440 Mujahideen in all, comprising 175 Afghan Mujahideen from Saifur Rahman Mansur's group, 190 Mujahideen from the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan under the command of Qari Muhammad Tahir Jan. This was the largest group, and about 75 Arab Mujahideen, the majority of whom had previous military knowledge and training. Footnote. All enemy excerpts describing their participation in and impressions of Operation Anaconda originated on the Taliban website www.azam.com and were generated by at least three individuals. Originally posted in 2003, they inevitably and eventually took on a predictable propagandist cast as the site was revised over the years. However, the author was able to corroborate original 2003 versions with friendly and enemy sources of information, such that the passages appearing in this book most closely reflect eyewitness accounts by enemy combatants at the time. However, no passage should be interpreted as accurate reporting of battle events, but rather as insight into the disposition and mindset of enemy combatants. By March 1st, more fighters had poured into the valley and were fortifying the surrounding mountains, preparing for jihad. J-Team had already survived two of Malawi Jawad's preparations. The forces housed and staged in Menjawar and at least one minefield. As the men adapted to their new surroundings and improved their OP, the next threat came to them. Satisfied the location was sound from a defensive consideration, with good lines of sight on the valley to their south and the surrounding mountains, they stashed the ATVs behind a 10-foot embankment situated below the OP and the riverbed they'd followed. According to Jay, the OP itself was bifurcated. One position was the mission support site, known as an MSS, where they set up their lone tent so two men could rest or eat. And the second was the actual observation post, 100 meters straight up the side of a ledge, where the three others would conduct operations. The way they'd situated it, one guy would watch the rear and the pair of men on the rest plan. One guy would watch the target area, and the other would do the reporting and pull security. The two positions maintained communications by way of M-Biter. At noon, the Taliban came, single file. They appeared from the cave area the men had passed hours earlier, traveling down the valley J-Team had left behind. They all appeared to be Afghans, not Arabs or Uzbeks, and they all had weapons to include RPGs. They were following the ATV tracks and stopped right where our tracks went up from the valley to our ATVs. Chris and Jay, who were manning the OP, observed them intently. Were they tracking J-Team? Was it merely a small patrol or the advance element of a much larger force? Chris had Bill and Dave take up positions, but neither could see the enemy, and further movement would only likely give away their position. J-Team's tracks were all over the place, so following the team's trail would prove difficult unless they happened upon the ATVs and the two Delta snipers hidden nearby. Then the Taliban sniffed out the tracks leading toward the ATVs. When they closed to 200 meters, Chris knew they were in trouble. Some of the thought process going on at this time was, these five personnel could be a point element for a larger force. If we shoot them, we would now be on the run by foot. If we shoot them, the mission could be compromised. If we let them go, they might bring back a larger force. And all the ATV tracks might have confused them, and they had no idea what was going on. As they continued to move inch by inch toward the ATVs, we got ready to engage them at the last possible minute. Jay sighted through the ACOG, Advanced Combat Optical Gunsight, scope of his suppressed M4 as the men approached. The Taliban below had no idea they were in the crosshairs of some of the deadliest shots in the world. The Delta snipers and Jay held the shot. Triggers brushed with the contact of each shooter's finger, poised to squeeze. At less than 200 meters, kills were a foregone conclusion for the Americans. You're watching this guy in your scope, thinking, I'm going to have to shoot this guy. And if you do, it's going to echo across the entire valley, and then you're done. With Jay and Chris above and the other two below, Chris kept the team in check even as the enemy closed to within 150 feet of the ATVs. The prospects weighed heavily on Jay's mind. With your scope, you could see they were talking about it. Hey, what is this? And pointing at the tracks. They'd walked away and then came back. Chris, Jay, and the snipers below weren't sure if they were compromised or not, but it seemed likely. Jay got on the net and brought in an ISR to scan the surrounding terrain and cover likely avenues of approach. For good measure, he coordinated for close air to be on standby in case the men were attacked. While Jay was working the airwaves, Chris called Blaber on the radio, using the whisper mode, which amplified the transmitter's voice so the receiver heard it clearly, and relayed the situation. Blaber responded, "What's your recommendation?"
"Well, if we kill him now, the whole valley will know we're up here, and we'll lose the element of surprise. Let me see what they do next. I'll call you back."
Chris describes what happened next. "Just as we got ready to fire, they stopped and paused for a few seconds, then talked to one another, and then just turned around and continued to walk out into the Shahikat Valley. One of them stayed back and went out of sight for about 5 minutes. We believe he walked back up toward the area from behind a rock that was in front of us, but because of the 10-foot embankment, could not see anything. Finally, we saw him walk back out and link up with the other four personnel." Chris called Blaber back after the enemy departed, explaining,
"We've plotted the grid for the cave entrance they walked out of, and Jay will coordinate a bombing mission on it at H hour."
The others broke down the tent and began hauling the remainder of the gear up to the OP. There would no longer be a lower position. All men would remain on the higher ground. The sun rose, but the weather closed as a gale-force snowstorm blew in. Nearly 2 feet of snow fell, allowing them to work their relocation, something they'd normally only accomplish in the dark, throughout a tense day. By nightfall, fresh snow had covered all the ATV and Taliban tracks, providing additional anonymity and security for the team. Anyone moving about now would be exposed by fresh tracks in the snow. The team felt safe, and with the immediate threat diminished, continued to consider their location. Further scouting revealed a small draw farther upslope with superior views of Turgul Gar, the whale. So they repeated the process of relocation throughout the night of March 1st, electing to leave the extra gear from the ATVs at the temporary OP, and putting more distance between them and the ATVs. As a security measure, Dave and Bill set a Claymore Mine booby trap with a tripwire to guard the downstream approach to the ATVs and to serve as an early warning from their rear, before leaving them behind for the duration of the mission. The new site provided another advantage in terrain dominance and masking should a larger force return. J-Team would be able to effectively attack with plunging fire. It also closed the distance between the MSS and OP to 50 feet, strengthening their mutual support. The site itself, though, was more exposed. All rock face with 6 to 10 foot ledges across the face and backside. There was sparse foliage, only scattered ankle-high brush. Jay recalls, "How we were positioned? We were not as concealed as you'd think you would be in the mountains of Afghanistan. I had a leaf suit on, but underneath a blue North Face coat. And it was not just that. I had a VS-17 panel out for IFF, identification, friend or foe. So if somebody flew over and saw us, an Apache or something like that, it wouldn't shoot at us." Theoretically, this was a real concern among the team. The unknown, was how well the pilots flying across hundreds of miles and dozens of mountains and valleys were briefed on three small and autonomous groups of Americans deep in enemy territory. Considering the close call with the Taliban, the men decided it was not all negative. It had unearthed their point of origin, the cave. Without realizing it during their wanderings through the terrain on infill, the team ended up no more than 700 meters from what was clearly a significant enemy position, much closer than they cared to be for an operation spanning more than a week. Looking through their sniper scopes, buildings could be seen as well. Footnote: the cave complex, as it came to be known, would later be revealed to have housed Osama bin Laden before his relocation to Tora Bora in December 2001. Chris's after-action report supported the notion. Based on all the security positions overwatching the cave, all the mule feces and signs of occupation, I would say there was a good chance of this being true. With his first target identified, Jay got to work, planning a pre-H-hour strike on the cave complex. For his first strike, he wasted no time on subtleties. He was going to announce the American campaign to Al-Qaeda with an earth-shattering bang. The cave complex was to be the recipient of a blue 118B 2,000-pound thermobaric laser-guided bomb, courtesy of a B-1 bomber crew. It would be the inaugural use of the newly redesigned and improved ordnance. As J-Team settled in and began reporting enemy positions and movements, Andy Martin and Mako 3-1 were waiting for daylight to wane in order to continue their infiltration. The waypoint afforded them a direct view of Shahi Kot's center and the village there. Before the morning storm moved in and eliminated all visibility, the team observed some Afghans fleeing the area with two camels in tow, overloaded with their possessions. If there were lingering doubts about knowledge of the pending operation, the hasty departure of locals removed them. Not taking any chances, Goody held his team in place till sunset, when they hefted their gear once again and moved out under cover of thick fog, hoping to make it to their OP. The night's hump proved more difficult than the first. The terrain was extreme, and sheer drop-offs and crevices created obstacles along their mountain trail. In 6 hours of movement, they managed barely 3 kilometers. As Mako 3-1 were beginning their second day, CCT Jim Hotaling, along with 6 Australian SAS troopers, sat freezing and huddled with his gear in the rear of another CIA-operated MI-17. He watched the valleys and peaks pass underneath in the Afghan twilight, thinking about the mission he'd received in Kandahar 3 days prior, with no notice or fanfare from Major Terry Maki, the commander of the 22nd STS. He'd had only 20 minutes to prepare before relocating to Bagram and meeting up with his team and their leader, Matt B. Hotaling was a 33-year-old reservist CCT. He'd been on active duty for several years before transferring into the Individual Mobilization Augmentee, IMA, program, which afforded former CCT, who didn't wish to be under the formal obligations of the Air National Guard, the opportunity to remain in the community. IMA allowed him to train with the 22nd STS at McCord AFB in Washington State, where he worked full-time as a state highway patrolman. At 5'11", he had a round, stocky build with tightly cropped coarse brown hair and jovial facial features, earning him the nickname Fozzie Bear. When the war kicked off, he'd been mobilized and then deployed to Afghanistan in October. Upon arrival, he and another controller by the name of John Wiley were immediately assigned to the SAS. For the next 3 months, he mission whored, a term that described jumping from unit to unit and mission to mission. It was the best opportunity to get in on action and airstrikes, and he bounced among the Aussie SAS's 1 Squadron, the Norwegian Marine Jäger Kommandoen, MJK, Special Forces, German Kommando Special Kräfte, KSK, and both B and C troops of SEAL Team 3. This ability to move freely among units, services, and allies, sometimes from week to week, or even on a daily turn, is unique to CCT, again, demonstrating the need to be competent and proficient across the spectrum of skills required in special operations tactics on a wholly global scale. Hotaling had done 8 previous missions with the Aussies, including one other high-altitude patrol. The SAS had endeavored to find a role in Anaconda and successfully lobbied for the opportunity to uphold a portion of the mission. For their efforts, they were rewarded with 2 patrols assigned to cover the south end of the Shahi Kot to prevent escape. The Aussies, recognizing their inexperience with U.S. air and airstrikes in general, immediately requested the 2 controllers they were familiar with. Pre-mission planning had been a whirlwind of coordination and packing for both controllers, neither of whom had worked with their assigned U.S. or SAS teams before. Short-notice assignments to unfamiliar units were nothing new, but both men knew the stakes in this particular situation were elevated. Not only did the SAS highly value their participation, but each controller carried the weight not just of the Air Force, but of the entire nation. Footnote. Based in part on Operation Anaconda, the Royal Australian Air Force, recognizing the need for a comparable capability down under, initiated the creation of its first combat control team in 2006. Designated B Flight No. 4 Squadron RAAF, it now operates from RAAF Base Williamtown, deploying Aussie CCT in support of Australian SOF worldwide. The Aussies tended to pack more heavily than their U.S. counterparts, so, as a result, Hotaling's ruck weighed 110 pounds. Unlike Jay Hill with Delta, who was reluctant to push weight onto his team, the Aussies ensured that the ruck of each man on the mission was within 2 pounds of his teammates. Still, to this, Hotaling added 30 pounds of combat load, including a vest with ammo, first aid, water, signaling devices, an M4 with suppressor and ACOG scope, and NVGs. The hour-long flight from Bagram was uneventful, but the men in back were keyed up. Like the SEALs, they'd had no recce experience in the mountains east of Gardez. The Hilo set down in the dark, 5 kilometers south of the Shahi Kot Valley, and the men struggled off the ramp under the weight of their packs. They trudged into the night and directly onto their intended OP, which had a commanding view of the approach and departure routes. Unlike Blaber's AFO teams, the Aussies, like the rest of the U.S. and Allied military, had no reservations about using rotary lift to insert, in this case right on top of the OP. It was also the reason the team was inclined to pack heavy. They did not intend to move or be resupplied, a decision they would soon regret. 6 kilometers to the north, Andy and the SEALs were anxious to arrive at their targeted location and acutely aware of their promise to Blaber. They moved out at 1430, still almost 2 kilometers from their OP, and the terrain between them and their objective was more challenging than the night before. This night completely drained the team, and they managed only 1,100 meters up the mountainous slope, finishing at nearly 11,000 feet above sea level and 600 meters short of their OP. As they moved, sweat poured from their bodies, soaking their shirts under their crushing loads. Pausing in the frigid mountain air even for a few moments caused them to freeze. It was something almost impossible to avoid. So although thighs burned with each heavy footfall and lungs ached with each gasp, it was better to keep moving than to stop. They occupied a hide site and established security, catching their breath and stretching their aching shoulders and backs. There was precious little time to take personal stock. It was close to midnight. H hour, the time at which 10th Mountain and the 101st Airborne were scheduled to land on the valley floor, was set for 06:30 the following day. If they were to get eyes on the valley before sunrise, they'd never get there as a team burdened with their packs and equipment. With little choice, Goody sent two SEAL snipers, Chris and Eric, forward to scout their final OP, while Andy established comms with AFO HQ. The two SEALs, free of their rucks, crept stealthily forward through the snow squall, scanning their surroundings for Al-Qaeda as they went. 200 meters forward of Mako 3-1's position, they were confronted by a gray-green 5-man tent wedged beneath a rock outcropping a few feet from a cliff's edge. Complete with a tin chimney protruding from one corner, it was exactly where the team planned to place their own OP. Al-Qaeda had arrived at the same conclusion, beating them to it by days. Chris, who'd been a SEAL for over a decade, and was the twin brother of a combat controller named Preston, pulled a Nikon Coolpix camera with an 8x lens from his mini pack to capture some shots for Andy to pass back, when Eric motioned for his attention. On the ridgeline 15 meters above the tent was the unmistakable silhouette of a tripod-mounted Russian Dishka 38, 12.7mm anti-aircraft machine gun, protected from the elements by a blue plastic tarp wrapped tightly around the barrel and receiver. Chris snapped some shots and then confirmed the weapon's location using his laser rangefinder and GPS. The discovery was fortuitous. The position dominated the entire 700-meter-wide approach corridor the TF Rakasan helicopters were to use for insertion in little more than 24 hours. The Dushka's 3,000-meter range placed the entire assault force in duck-shoot range. The two men watched the position for signs of fighters, but nobody showed themselves in the cold, so they silently withdrew back across the snow-covered ridgeline to report their findings, careful not to dislodge any rocks as the squall covered their withdrawal. Andy relayed a short message outlining what they'd discovered. At the AFO safe house, Blaber read the message, absorbing the new information, the first concrete evidence of enemy preparation for the assault. The SEALs went back for a second look in the light of day to determine whether the site was occupied and to get better photos, this time with Goody accompanying them. What they saw gave them pause. Two men were in the open. The first was a short, dark-haired and bearded Mongol, wearing typical Afghan tan man jammies and a sleeveless jacket of gray, red, and blue, topped by a brown wool hat. But it was the other man that caught the SEAL's attention, a tall, clean-shaven Caucasian with a full head of reddish collar-length hair. He was dressed for the elements in a heavy red Gore-Tex jacket, Polar Tech fleece liner, and Russian pattern camo pants. This man was clearly in charge of their fighting position. He'd carefully arranged ammunition in an arc around the Dishka's pit for rapid reloading when the time came. Both men seemed fit and healthy, the Caucasian occasionally shadowboxing with himself and strolling between the Dishka and the tent. At first, they assumed he was Uzbek, but the longer they watched, the less sure they were that they had his ethnicity pegged. At the hide site, Andy downloaded the photos onto his toughbook. Andy was the team's communications expert, but it was Goody's mission to lead. He quickly typed a message for Blaber and the SEAL Team 6 HQ, attached the photos, and hit send. Although Blaber was their immediate commander, the SEALs of Mako 3-1 were also reporting their actions directly to their chain of command in Bagram and excluding Blaber from these back-channel messages. This would have far-reaching and tragic consequences in the coming hours and days. Because of this, John Chapman in Bagram and Jay Hill across the valley were oblivious to the message traffic, which would also have consequences when Mako 3-1 began reporting more enemy locations in the coming hours, including on Taker Gar. Goody designated his message Eyes Only for Blaber and included the assessment that there may be as many as 5 fighters. The daytime photos clearly showed the Caucasian in his mountain redoubt, with the TF Rakasan insertion corridor stretching panoramically into the distance behind him. Mako 3-1's other concern was the possible presence of other Allied forces. The Aussies were already in the south, so Goody asked Blaber, "Are the Brits up here?" It was possible. The Mako 3-1 team looked nothing like an American force, and who knew if the Brits were similarly outfitted and using locals as part of some uncoordinated operation. The photos conveyed more detail and impact than any written report could. It was clear to Blaber that the Uzbeks and other foreign fighters were ready for a fight. Blaber assured Goody there were no Brits or other forces in their vicinity, and immediately passed the message to Bagram. It caused concern among the planners, who had been assured by the broader army and intelligence organizations, supported by dedicated satellites, surveillance aircraft, and even a CIA MI-17 video flyover just the previous day, that threats to the insertion force simply didn't exist. Before they'd even reached their OP, Mako 3-1, and by extension Blaber's entire AFO force and concept, were changing the looming battle. Goody, Andy, and the others needed to outline a plan. The Dishka would need to be eliminated before TF Rakasan entered the valley, and it was impossible to say whether the weapon and fighters, now only 600 feet from their position, were reinforced by a larger contingent tucked into the mountains nearby. But their mission was not to directly engage the enemy. They simply weren't equipped for any type of direct assault or sustained firefight. And there was the question of what Blaber might say. But some action had to happen. They simply couldn't allow the Dishka to stand. Even if TF Rakasan did modify their plan, Andy couldn't call in airstrikes from the current OP with an enemy force a stone's throw away. Eventually, they'd be discovered. The SEALs and Andy, all of them trained snipers, were not inclined to leave an enemy force standing, and they believed they could take them. But would Blaber agree? After further discussion, Goody got on his laptop and asked Blaber for guidance. Instead of providing direction, he asked the SEAL, "What's your recommendation?" To the SEALs and Andy, who were beginning to appreciate the Delta officer's leadership style, it was manna from heaven. Blaber, who was acutely aware of the precarious position of his teams, waited while his team leader absorbed the question. "I want to make sure we maintain the element of surprise as close to H hour as possible. I will wait until H-2 hours. At H-2, I will start moving. That will allow me to take my time getting into position. I'll engage at H-1 and then have Andy follow up with AC-130. For good measure, Goody followed that immediately with, "I understand that you have to make the decision on this, and I'll support any decision you make." Blaber, always one with a flair for the dramatic and not wishing to miss an opportunity, sent back, "Good hunting," smiling at the exchange. On a mountain deep in enemy territory, five men, seriously outnumbered and unsupported, smiled too. For the men of Mako 3-1, an opportunity such as this is why each became a combat controller, or a SEAL. At TF-11, everything was not smiles at Blaber's early reports, and photos circulated. Some of the staff believed Blaber was exceeding his mission. Mako 3-1 did not have sufficient men to attack the position, nor even doctrinal authority to conduct a direct action, according to one TF-11 staffer. "Peter the Great was at it again," scoffed another. Also taking note of the increased message traffic and the impact of AFO was the commander of SEAL Team 6, Captain Joe Kernan, and his ops officer, a SEAL named Tim Zemanski. Two of their men may have excluded themselves from AFO, but half of SLAB's Red Team sniper element was now decisively engaged in a big opportunity. For SLAB and the rest of the SEALs in Bagram, nothing was happening, and everyone in TF-11 was now fixating on Blaber's three teams in the field as Operation Anaconda began to spin up in preparation for combat operations. Wheels began to spin in the minds of the SEAL leaders. Back in Gardez, Blaber sent a final message to Goody, a 4-word mission statement: terminate with extreme prejudice. Falling back on his Navy vernacular, the SEAL acknowledged with a simple aye aye before signing off. Blaber looked at a map on the wall of the safe house. All three of his teams were in and open for business, ready for H hour. He was extremely proud of what the small, elite joint force was doing in that field and confident in their abilities. The enemy had a vote in what happened next, of course, and conditions remained perilous for the Delta, SEAL, and combat control operators. But he knew there was no one else in the world who could perform better in the days to come. At TF-11's JOC, Joint Operations Center, in Bagram, Brigadier General Trebon, the deputy TF-11 commander, was just finishing a conversation with Six's Captain Kernan. He picked up the phone to dial the AFO commander with some news. Chapter 14, March 2nd, Before Sunrise. The 2nd of March dawned with better visibility and weather for the AFO teams as temperatures approached a much welcomed 32 degrees Fahrenheit. Jay Hill and the Delta snipers were settled into their OP and had established a battle rhythm for reporting on the enemy. There was plenty to report. In addition to civilians fleeing the valley, positions were being fortified across the Whale, and forces could be seen mustering and repositioning. It was going to be a good day for killing. The mission was Delta-led, with Chris delivering the reports to Blaber while Bill and Dave did most of the scope spotting. The mission's statement and core, however, were all CCT. In preparation for orchestrating bomb strikes and gun runs, helicopters and fighters, Jay had 2 M-biters and his Prick 117, which, when combined with his Falcon View expertise, gave the team an unprecedented suite of lethality with which to decimate the enemy forces. I had my radios all set up, superior comms through the entire valley, Chris would make the calls to Blaber, and I'd worry about range finding, running down all the different targets, and nominating them. The day was well spent. Reporting back potential targets to Pete, Blaber, who would relay to Bagram who would... Well, Trebon and those folks I'm sure were listening to on Sat Alpha, the designated AFO satellite frequency. Everything was set up so we could talk to everybody, and we were in a good position where we had the entire valley covered. All he needed now were planes and bombs. Below him, in the center of the valley, the enemy's preparations, advance warning, and superior numbers did provide them certain advantages, but could they use them effectively? Intercepted requests revealed their concerns as well as their strategy. The traitors and their American allies are going to attack soon. We need to bring reinforcements to the village. Malawi Saif al-Rahman Nasrullah Mansour was the commander responsible for fielding such requests and for shaping the overall strategy. With hundreds of Mujahideen under his command, his assessment did not agree with his subordinates' request. Based on his experience as a subcommander under Haqqani in the Soviet campaign, during which they were victorious, he replied, "There is no need. We were in Shahikat during the first Afghan jihad against the Soviets. There were 6 Mujahideen in total, and we were surrounded by 10 tanks. Over 5 air attacks were staged on us in a single day, and there were about 100 Soviet soldiers who attacked us from the land. All praise belongs to Allah alone. They were not able to set foot on a single hand span of the village, and we remained in this same state for about 1 week. Convince the high ground, coupled with mortars and anti-aircraft systems throughout the valley, along with Allah's blessing, and the hundreds of fighters who'd fled from the north, was adequate to defeat the soft Americans. They waited, reciting their daily prayers." The stage was set for the morning's U.S.-led invasion on the Shahikat. 3 postage stamp size elements of America's finest troops, 13 men in all, waited to battle 1,000 to 1,500 hardened and experienced fighters of the jihad, who were arrayed across 200 square miles of fortified fighting positions. They were armed with heavy machine guns, anti-aircraft weapons, mortars, and artillery, and occupied the vast majority of the high ground surrounding the Shahikat Valley. Yet for all of AFO's capability and experience, Blaber's troops were merely peripheral to Operation Anaconda's main thrust. The plan to eliminate the enemy was simple. The U.S. Army intended to drop a few hundred infantry troops from the 10th Mountain and 101st Airborne onto the valley floor. They would then establish blocking positions against the mountains to serve as an anvil against which the theoretically terrified Al-Qaeda fighters fleeing ATF forces, augmented by Chris Haas's Green Berets, would be crushed. But Army planners did not have accurate enemy numbers, nor did they understand the enemy's intention. They also fundamentally misunderstood their foe, as evidenced by Mansour's directives. The Al-Qaeda field commander correctly assessed where the Americans would land and began moving troops into position accordingly. As the hours ticked down for the operation to commence, Juliet team continued to report enemy activity and waited for H hour. The plan was, prior to H hour, we would have control of fires, airstrikes, and after H hour, the 101st would have control. Jay was steadily building his target list, double-checking distances and locations with his Delta teammates, and occasionally exchanging information with Andy. He could feel the tension rising from the valley. Al-Qaeda and the Taliban could be seen on the Whale to his southwest and in the villages in the valley. Strangely, or not, as it would turn out, the latter had very few locals and none of the activity one would expect of daily Afghan life. Everywhere they looked were exclusively adult males moving with purpose. Other prominent sites, including the peak of Taker Gar to the south, also revealed enemy activity. In the valley, J-Team reported that the Army's HLZs remained clear of obstacles and enemy fortifications. This wasn't surprising since the HLZs, centered in the valley and on level ground in front of the mountain peaks, afforded no tactical advantage, save as level landing sites for the giant and slow CH-47s. It was on the Whale that most enemy activity could be seen, and Jay took particular note of the mortar pits. For J-Team, their initial role during the operation's kickoff was simple. According to Chris, Jay's B-1 that was striking the cave next to us was supposed to check in with us prior to dropping. The 101st would land and establish blocking positions, while the ATF came into Shahikat and did the dirty work. There was supposed to be a good fire support plan for mass bombing of the Turgul Gar, the Whale, and Taker Gar Mountains. At H-3 hours, we were cleared to engage targets. As day turned to night, and the night turned cold, the team took their last opportunity to attempt sleep while waiting for killing time to begin. On their OP, Jay had arrayed his CAS equipment ergonomically around him. Radios, scope, laser rangefinder, ISLID IR pointer. He tried to get some sleep. Maybe an hour and a half because you didn't want to go to sleep. 1, it was cold as hell. 2, it was the excitement pouring through your veins. I get to do some combat control shit here. Still, with an unknown number of straight combat days before him, we were trying. Thinking, if there's a time to sleep, you better do it now because you've got to conserve yourself for the next couple days. This thing is going to be a long time. But we had to take shifts with sleeping, and it never really worked out. The men sat, as silent as the night was dark, watching, waiting, knowing. As Jay froze in the pre-morning light, stuffed inside his puffy jacket, Andy and Mako 3-1 were already executing their pre-operation strike. Shortly after midnight, They had quietly jammed all their items into rucksacks, ensuring nothing would rattle or clang and betray them, picked up, and moved in the direction of the Dishka, while Chris traveled ahead of the others to find a site to stash their packs. When the rest arrived and dropped their rucks, Goody, Chris, and Eric began their slow approach toward the enemy's position. Andy stayed with the equipment, not for security, but to ensure he didn't give away their position when he began his airstrike coordination. He opened the top of his ruck to access the screen of his Prick 117 radio, turned it on, and configured it for operations. He then pulled the DMC-120 SATCOM antenna from inside and quickly assembled it, directing it at the appropriate satellite. He did a quick comm check on the net. Satisfied he was on the bird, he pulled out the tools of Combat Control's trade, nearly identical to Jay's, 9 kilometers to the north. Andy went through his mental checklist, comparing it with his plan to remove the Dishka after the SEALs killed the Al-Qaeda team leader they had seen outside the tent earlier. He finalized his preparations and sat back. Around him, the mountains were eerily silent. The SEALs made no sound as they closed in for the kill. He checked his watch. A little more than an hour to go. A sound reached his ears. The low, steady drone of a lone turboprop plane overhead. He looked through his NVGs at the reassuring shadow, invisible to the naked eye, that was making slow, 2-minute turns, orbits, in the distance. Andy smiled to himself. The first of the aerial predators had arrived. Grim 3-1, an H-model AC-130 Spectre gunship. It was Andy's favorite execution tool for conditions such as this. He shivered in the cold and thought, it's going to be a good day. Chris led the other SEALs as they crept toward the enemy camp. Clouds came and went, alternately illuminating and then masking the terrain. They slid their way to a ridgeline, and he realized they were only 60 feet from the darkened tent. Chris was in front, the other two behind him to minimize their profile against the sky. The snipers double-checked their rifles, 2 Stoner SR-25s and an M4, and marked the time. It was now 2 hours before TF Rakasan forces were to land in the valley, H-2. Chris recalls what happened next. I observed a man come over the top of the ridge and look down into the valley. He came from the direction of the tent that we could not observe at the time. I then realized how close we were to the site. The individual returned to the tent, and we continued to wait. Clouds cleared, and we could now hear the gunships overhead. There were 2 in the valley. I observed the same sentry come out to the same spot. He was looking out to the west again. I slowly crouched down and tried to get the attention of Goody and Eric. Before I could, the sentry looked our way just as Eric stood up. Due to the illumination, he easily spotted the movement and turned and ran toward the tent. The SEALs had compromised themselves. Left with no choice, Goody ordered the attack. The sentry was shouting at his comrades to wake as the 3 SEALs charged over the ridge. Chris stopped and fired 1 shot before his rifle jammed. Goody took a knee and had fired his first round into the tent when his rifle also jammed. Both men were shooting the SR-25s, each with a suppressor, providing muzzle flash masking as well as sound reduction, and both had iced up. The 2 men frantically worked to clear their weapons. The sentry, by then inside the tent, unloaded a full magazine from his AK-47 at them. The SEALs could see the blinding muzzle flash from between the folds of the tent flaps. They'd stirred up a veritable hornet's nest as men poured out of the tent with weapons in hand. 1, a Chechen, charged Chris, who had finally cleared his jam. Chris pumped several rounds into the chest of his assailant, dropping him in the snow mere feet away. A 2nd broke right, lunging toward the Dishka, but was blasted by Chris and Goody simultaneously. Their problems were just beginning. From the team's left, a fighter was flanking them. Eric dispatched the AQ soldier as Goody got on the radio to Andy, who was already moving toward the gunfire. The difference between the American and Al-Qaeda weapons is very easily distinguished, and it sounded to the controller like his men were on the losing side, based on the volume of hostile fire. As if in confirmation, a sustained burst of 7.62 passed just over his head, the telltale tracer rounds carving a slow-motion arc in front of the silent, starry backdrop. Grim 3-1, fully briefed by Andy, was moving overhead at 20,000 feet above mean sea level, less than 10,000 feet above the team's mountainous ridge. Its 40mm Bofors cannon and 105mm howitzer ready and trained on the Dishka and tent. The pilot reported to Andy they had two enemy bodies just outside the tent and another wounded and crawling away. Andy and the SEALs met halfway. As he was telling Chris they needed to pull back so he could destroy the Dishka position, Grim 3-1 announced through Andy's headset that there were two other figures moving north of Mako 3-1 trying to get on their left flank. The flankers were only 75 meters away and appeared to be emplacing a machine gun. When a sustained burst of 7.62 PKM fire raked the ridge near the team's position, it obviated the need for further confirmation. They were in serious trouble. An H-model gunship's danger close for its 40mm Bofors was 125 meters. For the 105mm, it was 600 meters. The team was well under 100 meters from the Dishka, and more fighters were appearing from the night, attempting to engage Mako 3-1. Relief was up to Andy, who had Grim 3-1 poised with an at-my-command weapons release. The team continued its retreat as Grim 3-1 waited to hear the words that would authorize the unleashing of the first 33-pound, 1,550-foot-per-second high-explosive shell. While the men tumbled across the rough terrain, pursued by tracer fire, Andy uttered them. "Cleared hot," he stated in a steady but winded voice. The weapons of an AC-130 can only be fired by the pilot, who always sits in the left seat, the same side as its deadly cannons and sensors. As soon as the pilot, Major D.J. Turner, heard the clearance, he checked his sensor operators in the rear to ensure his friendlies were clear, and then pulled the trigger. It took the 105 round a little less than 7 seconds to travel the distance, sticking its landing with a thud and whoomp felt by Andy and the team. Back inside the